I first spoke with Amadeela Siddiqui last week, and when I got him on the line, one of the first questions I had was simple. I wondered how he, an Afghan national, thought an American drawdown in Afghanistan might go. I just wondered if he'd pictured it in his head. It turned out he hadn't.
I couldn't imagine how, you know, that would happen.
You couldn't imagine the Americans leaving?
No.
This week, it became clear just how many Afghans felt the exact same way, as Kabul's airport filled up with desperate people, willing to do just about anything to catch a flight out of town. Amadeela is comparatively lucky. He lives in Houston. He's got American citizenship. He fled years ago after his work as a U.S. government translator resulted in death threats. In that first call we had, he couldn't stop thinking about the colleagues he'd left behind. Some had been waiting years to get out. For others, it was already too late.
Yeah, like our coworker, he got his visa. He was waiting for the flight and he got shot while, you know, trying to meet his grandmom and dad. He got shot. Many more people got shot before he came to the States.
Do you feel a little helpless?
Well, yes. You know, the interpreters and those who work with them, they can't do anything. The only way is they stay and die. Because in 1990s, you know, when the Taliban attacked, the borders were open. People could easily, you know, escape or leave the country to neighboring countries. But now that all the borders are closed, the only way is to stay and die.
Then, this week, Kabul fell. The Taliban took charge. So we decided to call Amadeela back.
So, Amadeela, can you just describe how your world has changed in the last few days?
Well, as far as my world and everything just collapsed down, that the things happened that we even did not imagine that would happen that fast. Things changed so rapidly, nobody could easily understand. And it's shocking. It's scary.
Today on the show, now that the Taliban is firmly in control, the U.S. government estimates there are tens of thousands of Afghan nationals trying to leave their country. Between desperate text messages from friends and family, Amadeela agreed to tell me some of their stories. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around.
This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
The despair you're seeing right now at Kabul's airport, Amadeela knows exactly what that feels like. Not just because he left Afghanistan himself, but because he wakes up to dozens of messages every day from Afghans like him trying to leave. Amadeela now works at the nonprofit No One Left Behind, helping other interpreters flee. That means constantly fielding requests for help. And in the last few days, those requests have only ramped up. Thousands are stuck behind bureaucratic red tape, trying to get to safety.
It really is overwhelming at some point. But in the meantime, I have to, you know, take care. I have to be alert. I have to be watchful to see what people are going through. And it's our job to be in touch with people who need our help in this situation. So We are trying our best to help as much as we can to bring our allies home.
This mission is as personal as it gets for Amidullah. His entire family, all 7 siblings and his parents, they're still in Afghanistan. Because of his past work with the U.S., they've been moving house to house to stay safe. And that was before the Taliban took control of Kabul.
Can you introduce me to the relatives you still have in Afghanistan?
I have my immediate family there, my siblings, my brothers. They're all younger than me, like 20s, 18s, 13, 21, something. My mom and dad, they're still in Afghanistan.
How are they doing now?
Well, they're moving around. They're hiding. They can't go out because they're scared of my work with my affiliation with the U.S. forces.
So have they thought about just going to the airport? I mean, you've seen so many people doing that. Did they ever consider it?
Well, they wanted to, but I didn't let them, because if you don't have the proper documentation, and what if you are being caught by insurgent groups and Taliban? So that's why I stopped them. I said, okay, wait until you get documentation, then you can go leave the country.
How long do you think the documentation will take? Do you know?
That's the problem. So we ought to let everybody know here that how risky it is to live in that country right now. I'm waiting for the paperwork to get out to me. And as soon as I get him, I'll let them know to get out of there.
The right paperwork is key to getting out of Afghanistan. For some visas, like the special immigrant visa for Afghans who assisted the U.S. government, the application can take months, even years, to get approval. There are letters of recommendation applicants have to get from their U.S. supervisors and interviews to go through. No One Left Behind, Amidullah's organization, they estimate more than 300 interpreters have died just while waiting to get their applications processed.
You need to have paperwork. You need to have something from the embassy. You need to have something from the National Visa Center, you know, while you are waiting for your visa.
It took you a year, right?
It took me a year, but still there are some people who are waiting for years only for their interviews. And they keep calling me, texting me. Right now I'm interviewing you. I'm seeing a lot of, you know, text messages and in emails are coming in. They are waiting, you know, for a help. They said that, what should we do? Paperwork. We don't know how long will it take.
So you're literally getting text messages and emails right now from people saying...
Right now. People saying that, what should we do? Show us a way to get out of here. Even though they work with the U.S. forces, they are still waiting for their paperwork to complete. Thousands of people are still there.
I mean, the American government has said, we want to evacuate people who worked with us. That is our plan.
If that is the plan, then why there are thousands of people waiting? Only for the approval. They send their paperwork and they are waiting for the approval. They don't get anything. They send the email to the embassy. They send email to the NVC, National Visa Center, but they don't get a reply back.
Reading accounts from people stuck inside Afghanistan, there are all of these incredibly heartbreaking moments. Like this one woman who works for a Western NGO in Kabul. She wrote for The Guardian. She said, when we were evacuated from our office, some of my male colleagues joked with us and said, oh, it's the last time we'll ever see you again. We'll have to get permission from your brother to see you. And they thought it was funny. And it just, I didn't know what to make of that. I found it's just so harsh. But at the same time, of course, you understand gallows humor. I wonder if your family is telling you any stories like that.
Well, that's true. I have friends, you know, families down there in, you know, they were working. They suddenly, everything shut down. They stopped home, you know, they are locked. Some of them were locked. Some of them just, you know, left the offices. They're still, you know, at their homes. They can't even come out in fear of getting caught by the Taliban. And because they have their paperwork, most of them, they just, you know, trashed or they just, you know, put their documents away.
Because they don't want to be identified.
Of course, yes. Even they removed and they cleared their phones, everything that they had, all the documents. And that's true. That's scary. You know, if you, it was kind of a joke with that woman, but that's the fact now. You know, you never know what happens with these fundamentalists.
Were they clearing documents that they might need to leave the country, but they just felt like it was a choice between having the documents and being alive?
Well, they cleared it because they already applied at some point. So they might have sent it to a friend, a close friend, the documents, and then they cleared everything up. If they need him, they will get it. But at the moment, to stay there, you don't have to have those, even though the Taliban announced that they won't say anything. But you can't believe them because we have witnessed from the past, and they're the same people.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about that, because one of the things that stands out to me about this moment is that the Taliban, I heard one reporter call it a charm offensive. Like, they seem to be coming out and saying, you know, women can still work. A Taliban member did an interview with a female journalist on television, you know, sort of giving these messages that it's a new Taliban. Do you believe that?
It's a joke, actually. Even in 1996, when they had the control over the country, for the first few months, they were the nicest people on the earth, you know. And later on, oh my God, I can't explain what they did to the people. And they never changed. Actually, the fundamentalist and extremist groups, they never changed because they don't believe in democracy. They don't believe in women empowerment. They don't believe, you know, in human rights. As I said before, in 1996, after a few months, they took the control over all over the country. And then they came with their own Sharia laws and these, you know, the laws that they have. So most of them were actually nonsense. So they never change. And
do you remember that time when they came into power last time?
I was a kid, actually. I was around 6 or 7. So I don't remember a lot of stuff. But since then, I have watched everything. We were kids, but we were mentally tortured. You know, when you were a 7-year-old kid, and you see all these, you know, things happening in front of your eyes, how can you ignore that? How can you forget that? Those nightmares that they brought to us, the women couldn't go to schools. We didn't have internet. We didn't have technology, nothing at all. And now, like in the past 20 years, girls were going to schools, universities. We had educated people, many masters, you know, even we have PhDs. Many women were working with NGOs. We had free speech media. So of course, we had some problems, but overall, it was good. Now we don't know. They are okay. They are the nicest people right now, but you don't know what will happen next. They need to show the people how good we are, how nice we are. But they have given their exam once.
One of the things that stood out to me reading some of these accounts from people inside Afghanistan is how people around the country seem to be shutting themselves down, shutting themselves off from each other. Like this woman who worked at an NGO who wrote for The Guardian talked about going to her boss at the NGO and saying, help me get a visa. And the boss said, oh, no, you'll be fine. I'm not going to help you get a visa. Or going to a Western women's rights activist and asking for help and being told, I can't help you. You can just get a pretend husband. And to me, that it seemed so dark that people were turning away from each other at this moment. And I guess it could be self-protection, but it surprised me. Are you hearing accounts like that?
How is it possible that somebody works with you and then you turn your back to that when they need you? So where is the humanity? Leave everything aside. Where is the humanity that, you know, everybody's talking about human rights and human rights? Where are that? If I work for you, I risk my life for you. When you need me, now I need you. So it's the time. You got to help everybody as much as you can. Help each other. Actually, nobody wants to leave their own country unless you have to.
The number I've heard from the American government is 18,000 people waiting to get out, sort of somewhere in the process of getting a visa. But do you think that number actually reflects how many people are trying to get out of the country right now?
Well, it's more than that. 18,000 is just on a paperwork who got their approvals. There are more than that who are not even qualified for the visa program, but they have worked. They're trying to reach out to their supervisors, you know, to the company they have worked with, but everything shuts down. Nobody answered them.
Amadil's family finds themselves in a similar situation. They don't qualify as SIVs, like Amadullah. Those visas are only available to people who actually worked for the U.S. government or their spouses and kids. But because they're close relatives to a translator, they're still at risk. You're in Texas now. Your whole family's in Afghanistan. I can't imagine being in your situation, sort of waiting to hear. I read one person writing about her situation where she was in a similar state. She worked with the international community, and so she was able to apply for a visa. And she put it in this really gutting way. She said, "When I'm sad, I say my life is worth more than my sister's, because they didn't have a chance to work with the Western community. They don't have a pathway out." And I wonder if in your darker moments, that's something you wonder about yourself.
I imagine or not, since the Taliban, got into, and they have the control, I haven't slept well for nights. Just like 3-4 hours a night, wake up and check my phone, what's going on. I check my phone like even 5 to 6 times at night.
Like you wake up in the middle of the night and check it?
No matter what time it is, I just wake up 3-6 times. It's been days now to see if something is at risk, to see if something is there, to see if my dad is okay, my mom is okay. It's not only me, it's thousands of other people, actually.
After the break, the risks involved with getting out of Afghanistan. Stick around.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
I know that even before now, you'd been warning about the danger to people like you, people who worked for the American government in Afghanistan, as this transition takes place and troops leave. You told me the last time we talked this awful story about a translator who was actually on his way to a flight and was killed. I'm wondering what stories you're hearing now about people who are trying to get out, who know they're at risk, who are trying to maybe get through checkpoints.
The other day, two interpreters were killed by Taliban. And their pictures were shown on social media everywhere. And there are some people, they even can't come from the city, you know, from the suburbs on outside the country, the surrounding countries, you know, the suburbs where they live far away in the other provinces. They even cannot come to Kabul to reach out to the embassy. I heard stories that people are, you know, being checked, being searched on the way to Kabul.
Yeah, the American government has said we're committed to helping people get out of Kabul, but there's been less said about helping people get to Kabul to get out.
So how can they help people to get out of even Kabul while thousands of people are waiting outside the embassy? Actually, there is no embassy right now, but they're in the airport. The embassy is in the airport. Thousands of people are waiting outside in the sun, the kids. So if y'all have a proper documentation, a mechanism for them, so there should be a technique or a mechanism where they can easily get everybody in who are eligible.
There have been accounts that some Taliban are letting people with documentation leave the country. Do you trust that? Have you heard that?
How can you believe them? How can you believe the people who have killed interpreters and in people who work with U.S. forces?
It seems like right now there's kind of a race going on because there are so many Afghans who want to leave their country.
Yes.
But the Biden administration has set a deadline to end the evacuation mission by August 31st, which is very soon. Do you think that's enough time to get people out of the country?
I don't think so. Because there are thousands of people waiting, how can you get them out? They said, okay, we will leave in, they said September 11, but there are thousands of people. How can they do that? If they just only bring those who got their visas or those who are waiting for their interviews, that's one story. There are thousands of other people who still don't have their approval, COM approval, from the National Visa Center. They submitted all the paperwork. What will they do with them?
It must be really hard, first of all, to be in the U.S. by yourself, but then also fully embrace this country when you feel it's so thoroughly letting you and people you love down. I don't know. Maybe you see it differently.
It really is. It really is. So you are here, you feel safe, but your mind is there. You're physically here, but you're mentally somewhere else. But that's what I said, you know, I want to ask everybody to listen to the SIVs. You know, these are unsung heroes. These are hidden heroes. They work with us shoulder to shoulder in a battlefield. They were in the front line when they were on a mission. They were on a directly fighting with the Taliban or with the insurgent. They were on the front line. They were showing our troops the way, where to go, the communications. You know, they were the cultural advisor. They were multitasking.
Who do you hold responsible for the situation you're in now? With so many translators still in Afghanistan, your family still in Afghanistan, and all this paperwork seeming to hold things up, who do you blame?
Well, it's government. The government should take action, honoring our nation's promise to, you know, the interpreters who risk their lives for our country and our soldier and for our democracy is a promise we have to fulfill right now.
Do you ever imagine going back to Afghanistan?
I don't know. I can't say anything because everything can happen there, especially in the past weeks, in the past months.
What would you say to Joe Biden if he asked you? He was asked point blank, does the U.S. bear responsibility for people who are dying now? And he said no.
I want to see him for 5 minutes. Give me 5 minutes.
How do you use those 5 minutes?
I just want to talk about, you know, how I feel, how as an Afghan, what I feel that I work with our forces in Afghanistan. And I will show him the facts, the real facts, the examples. I will have a 5-minute presentation and tell him what's going on. How can you leave a country like that? It's okay. We really respect that decision from the bottom of our heart. But at the same point, we know that, you know, we have equipped them with everything. But again, we are a strong nation here. U.S. is one of the strongest nations, number one in the world. So we got to stop. We can't stop them.
And some people would say, it's a quagmire. We've tried so hard for 20 years, and we have to leave at a certain point. We have to go. What would you say to those people?
We had a mission there. We completed the mission. But if we don't stop them, their history will repeat. If we don't stop them, that will be the biggest threat to the world, to the United States, and to the international communities.
Amadeh Siddiqui, thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Amadeh Siddiqui is a former interpreter for the U.S. in Afghanistan. He's also an ambassador for the group No One Left Behind. He's based out of Houston. He's dedicated to bringing interpreters from Afghanistan and Iraq to the U.S. All right, that's the show. What Next is produced by Carmel Delshad, Elena Schwartz, Daniel Hewitt, Mary Wilson, and Davis Land. We get oversight from Allison Benedict and Alicia Montgomery. And I'm Mary Harris. Tomorrow, stay tuned to this feed. Lizzie O'Leary is going to be here with What Next TBD. They're going to be talking all about vaccine booster shots for COVID. I know you've got questions. I totally do. Anyway, come catch the show, and I will catch you back here on Monday.